Okay, well, welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia during our Sunday morning meeting. The United Lodge of Theosophists is an association of students of theosophy. And so some people wonder what theosophy is, and others think, theosophy is anything that seems interesting and psychic to you. But actually, when you come to the Lodge, the United Lodge of Theosophy, the philosophy of theosophy is theosophical teachings, principles that are found in the writings of William Q. Judge and H.P. Blavatsky, who are the co-founders of the Theosophical movement. So here, we promulgate the principles of the philosophy. We do so as a purely volunteer association. Each and all, together, independently and collectively, devoted to the cause of theosophy, which is to keep these ideas before the public. Ancient ideas, always known, made available to the public according to the right cycles. Often it's not safely made available to the public, but during these times, since 1875, it's become very widely known for those who have been seeking it out. Now, who is a theosophist? Well, the Lodge holds as a theosophist anyone who lives in the true service of humanity without regard to race, creed, sex, any kind of distinction, but to humanity at large, without any of those limitations. And as a lodge, as an association, we are banded more as a family or a movement with a similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching. That's what we have in common, is the teaching. It's not an organization where we vote for presidents and officers and have bylaws and those kinds of things. Rather, the rule of law, so to speak, is found in this document, which we call the United Lodge of Theosophists Declaration, which is the same declaration for all the lodges all over the world for well over 100 years, and it works. So, the Lodge welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes, as found in the Declaration, and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. So, we carry out the Declaration and the purpose of the movement by having here two meetings in Philadelphia, one as we have here on a Sunday every week from 11 to 12. The doors open at 10:30. And at this Sunday meeting, it's a formal presentation of an aspect of the philosophy, different every week, but always either an individual lecture or a panel discussion for part of the hour, but most of the hour is devoted to talk and discussion and dialectic to come to understand the root of the issues discussed from a theosophical viewpoint. Now, today's topic is law, chance, or miracle. For the month of November, every Sunday, all the Sundays for the month of November, the broad topic for the month is basic theosophical principles. And today is law, chance, or miracle. Now, on a Wednesday evening, you could come here at 5:15. The doors open at 5:15 because the reference library is open and available to the public. And it's not a lending library, but you'll find that the literature in there is all theosophical, straight-line theosophical literature and there's always someone in there to help you if you're in pursuit of a particular line of study that you think you could get deeper than you have been, but you're looking and searching. It's a wonderful library for those purposes. There's also so this is Wednesday night. That's from 5:15 to 7:15. Then from 7:30 to 8:30, this year we have each Wednesday a study class in the book called The Key to Theosophy, written by H.P.B. And that goes from 7:30 to 8:30. It's carried on in a similar fashion of first a brief presentation of the part of the chapter we happen to be doing that week, and then talk and discussion on that topic. So that's a Wednesday evening. Now, the Lodge is open to all and free to all. We never charge for the services and the lectures that we hold for the public. All of our functions are, but of course it takes money to keep it going. So volunteers, time, service, and money, everything that goes on here, everybody who you see contributing is not paid a dime to do anything. And yet this lodge here in Philadelphia is coming up very quickly on its 100th anniversary. So we think probably it would not exist anymore if it didn't contribute some kind of value to somebody who was willing to, you know, help out. All the money goes to keeping the lights on, literally, and keeping it hot in the winter, cold in the summer. Okay? So that's it. So, without further ado, by the way, just to let you know, next week's topic is reincarnation, the doctrine of hope. This week's topic is law, chance, or miracle. We will have a panel discussion. First presentation will be for a few minutes on law, or chance and miracle, and then a presentation on law from a theosophical point of view, and then there'll be plenty of time for questions and answers.
Chance or miracle? Chance is usually positive or negative in experience, depending on what happens. Miracle, however, is usually something very positive and often religious in tone. So they're alike in that they happen to us, but they are different in their effect. So, you know, chance, the first thing that comes to mind is the lottery. You buy a ticket for 10 years and you finally win, let's say, $5,000. Well, you might have made up the money you spent. You might not have, but the chance that you would comes in buying the ticket. Another example of chance is a dear friend of ours who was some time ago doing very, very well in business. He was, he eventually had his own company and worked with others, and finally something happened where he went bankrupt. So over a period of time, he was getting more and more desperate. Opportunities were not coming his way. Finally, one day he runs into an older friend who says, "How you doing?" And he says, "Terrible. I've lost everything. I don't know what I'm going to do." And the gentleman says, "As a matter of fact, I started a company and I'd be thrilled to hire you. I know your experience, your skill, your knowledge." And he got back on the road to being the wealth isn't the major thing. He got back on the road to being working and productive and feeling good about it. So both of these were positive experiences. But very different from our, what we want to present as our experience as a miracle. Often, miracles are, said to happen when it comes to health. Let's say there's two people in a hospital room with the same illness. And one's a little girl, and she's dying from this illness, whatever it is. And all of her friends and family pray for her and wish her the best of health and success in overcoming this. And miraculously, she does. She starts back on the road to health and eventually resumes her health, where the person in the other bed who was very much alone and didn't have anyone visit very often died from the same illness. So the family would say, well, this was a miracle. The doctor said this child was going to die. This had to be a miracle. And we all prayed, so God must have made this happen. Now we get tricky. Because why would one person receive that kind of blessing and the other not? What are the criteria by which this happens? Who or what decides who should live or die? And is it possible for a being to make such decisions? So we have to examine these situations and seek their root, their motive, the circumstances around which everything happened, and compare them to what we're going to hear from the next speaker. But if we really think about it, it doesn't make a lot of sense, chance and miracle. They're too arbitrary. If we truly are working in this lifetime, and I don't want to step on your toes, yes. to do our very, very best.
I need the help.
Then this would be the farthest thing from our mind. We would know that things happen because they're supposed to happen. We're not given more than we can handle. And we'll talk about why in a minute. So chance and miracle are arbitrary. They are left to the interpretation of those who experience them. And like other things, they are either experienced by the person as good or bad, rather than being good or bad in themselves. So we'll let you take over there.
Thank you. So when it comes to chance and miracle, you know, most folks tacitly will verbalize, well, we live in a universe of law. You know, for instance, what's the chance of me burning my hand if I press it against the coil on my stove? Well, it's pretty much going to happen under law no matter what I do, and I recognize that, so I'm not going to take that chance, right? So if we live in a universe of law, then there's a lot of things that go on that, because of the way Westerners typically think, just doesn't make sense, and which makes the way for a miracle, the excuse for a miracle. So let's just for this hour accept that everything happens under law, even though we can hope for the raise, but really if we haven't done anything to earn the raise, then that's tacitly believing in miracles, isn't it? Right? So let's just look to see everything is according to law. If we walk across the hot coals, we're going to burn our feet. That's the way heat works when we step on it. But there actually are a lot of peoples, indigenous peoples in different areas of the world, who can do the same thing and their feet don't get burned. So is that a miracle? Well, there's something going on there, and theosophy would say, by all means, that's no miracle. There's something going on, whether it's use of will or a deeper understanding of the laws of nature. It could even happen, they may not know exactly what the laws are, but they can be taught how to do this. So these laws that we don't understand, perhaps, are what's behind the working of miracles. So really, there are no miracles, but everything, you know, there's nothing supernatural doing a miracle to anybody. This idea of supernatural, you know, stems so far back. The ancients recognized the divine in all, the God or the divine in nature and the divine absolute. But at a certain point in the Western world, we made a separation. We, the folks, there's the natural world and then there's God, and God doesn't have to follow the same laws. Or maybe there's God's laws and the natural laws. So to this day, people will pray to God, hoping that some way, somehow, something will come about miraculously, when really anything that does come about is the effect of a cause. It is the result of something that we've done or haven't done earlier in the day, 2 years ago, or perhaps even in a past life. Now, we may not understand why things happen, the good and the bad, but if we take a moment and consider the ideas of karma, cause and effect, and its twin doctrine, reincarnation, then we can see that we, each of us, an immortal soul, using forms on a cyclical basis, using physical bodies from time to time, have the opportunity to experience at last the effect of all causes that we ever set up. These effects come to us because they're opportunities to learn. They're simply opportunities to learn. Now, HPB would say that the laws that go on behind the scenes that maybe we don't have clear understanding on, she uses the word preternatural. Preternatural, we looked it up in the dictionary, and in one sense it says supernatural, but in another sense it says mysterious and psychic type of a law. And so it's a law that operates in certain ways that we don't recognize or understand yet, but that doesn't mean that it's not a law, and that doesn't mean that we can't come to understand and recognize it. Because there's a lot about ourselves that we don't understand and recognize either, isn't there? So that doesn't mean that we're not operating according to law on other planes. Well, if we are, then we're bringing about effects that we may not understand the cause, but if we generally accept that whatever comes to me is my responsibility, there's no way it could have come to me if I didn't put it in motion, and if I was, you know, strong and powerful enough to put this a problem in motion, then I'm strong and powerful enough to deal with it and to rise above it and fix it and even things out to put harmony back into nature. So we'll stop there for now and open it up to contributions and questions and see what else we can tease out from this idea of law. Yes? And then.
Well, this general topic is on theosophical principles.
Right.
And a principle is the basics of thought and action. It's not just a theoretical intellectual exercise. So what difference does it make in our lives whether we hold on to the idea that things happen mostly out of chance, we're either lucky or unlucky, or out of miracle, or things happen according to law? What difference would it make in our everyday lives?
What difference does it make in our everyday lives if we either believe that things occur according to miracles or things occur only according to law? Well, first of all, as we understand it, most Western psychologists would tell you, whether you understand, you know, first of all, typically you try to get to the cause of any problem, and that helps to solve the problem. But for those problems that you can't get to the cause of, if we accept that it comes to me not because I'm a victim, but because I'm able to handle it, and it's mine because it, whether or not you believe in past lives, if we simply accept the challenges that we, and accept that if it came to me, I have the power to fix this, then it's empowering, and it's the opposite would be, well, I'm a victim, and somebody else, it's coming from the outside. Theosophy would tell us that everything that goes on with us ultimately is coming from us for our own learning. So it's empowering to recognize it as an operation of law.
And it's also the difference between taking responsibility for your actions, thoughts, words, deeds, or saying, well, I'm not responsible for that. That just happened willy-nilly. You know, that was just by chance that that happened. And what we need to do is take responsibility and, as was said, root out the cause. Try and find, be the gardener, find why this plant isn't growing properly, and use all the tools you have because you were given them, because you're supposed to have them and they are necessary for this work.
There was a hand.
Me personally, a lot of times in my own personal life situations and circumstances, I sit back and I listen to a lot of people say certain things, but through my own self-experience, we have a higher self and a lower self. The things that we need to search from within. And when you find those things that you need to work on from within, then make sure that your purpose is not to gain wealth and deprive someone else that's qualified for certain situations and certain positions in the world from their gift and their talent. Because I found out if you find out your gift and your talent, once you separated the negative things that fights us from within, then when you work, it will not feel like work and it would not feel like pressure. So everything else will come in to be completion as well.
Thank you. So what we think is being said here is as we look within, as we consider the challenges and how did this come to me under law, the contributor said, you know, if we find that we've got something to gain out of this, then we're probably not operating from the higher self. If when we observe, we find ourselves taking more responsibility for this coming back to me again, if we find ourselves dealing with it in a different way than we did last time because it's come back again and maybe we should try something different, then we're probably operating, you know, we've taken a step up toward the higher self. Thank you. Yes, in the back, the lady in the back.
We were given a great piece of advice about practically facing the difficulties. Picture a professor standing in front of an empty blackboard, and then you are told, solve the problem. In other words, a problem is an opportunity because you can't fix something until you see what it is. So instead of doing what we usually do, complaining about our difficulties, we should sit down and really think about it.
Thank you. Yes.
It's really difficult in this society to separate the miracles from the chance and such, mainly because this being a Christian nation, the Bible plays a large part in our belief system. One of the stories in the Bible that has always fascinated me, and I'd really like to know what theosophy makes of it, is the story of the Jews escaping Egypt and the waters roll up on both sides so that they can cross the Red Sea. Now, that's an illustration of a God breaking natural law to manifest his will. What would theosophy say of that?
As we recall, HPB talked about that, and on the one hand, it's a metaphor for the value of following the law, but it actually harkens back to an actual experience that was part of the human experience in Atlantis and with all of the things that went on, and that's a whole different investigation. That's what the library's for. But yes, the lady with the... whatever that's called.
There is a letter which we can print and put in the library for people where the President of the United States wrote a Muslim country saying, we are not a Christian country. Now, we all kind of hold that idea because it's so brought up in front of us, but we're not. We are, in that sense, a nothing religious but very spiritual country.
Thank you. Yes.
We don't remember where we saw that it was a scientific study done. They went through all of the plagues and scientifically explained how each one, and they were all kind of built on, like one caused the other, caused the other, caused the other. Because they're, you know, in the Bible, they're all looked at as being miracles, but in reality, they were all scientific, natural phenomena that happened. And we believe they even explained the splitting of the Red Sea, although we can't remember exactly what the natural cause was for that. But it's a really interesting study, I'm sure it can be found on the internet, and we've heard it in two different places.
Thank you. Yes, just hand you.
Well, the previous contribution points out the problem. On one hand, we have science trying to explain everything that happens to us on a rational basis of law. And then on the other hand, we have our religions, which tell us that we have to believe things happen for reasons we don't understand, and it's a miracle. So these two important human endeavors forever seem separate. So how does the idea of karma, or the law of cause and effect and cycles, bring these two together, to unite them, so there isn't that kind of divide?
Okay, well, as we understand it, science, religion, and philosophy were considered, you know, a pursuit toward truth for the educated in the ancient mystery schools. Now, what went on in Western Europe, in the universities of Western Europe, as they evolved, there were degrees you could get, a doctor of theology, a doctor of medicine, a doctor of law, and a doctor of philosophy. Now, here's the key. Doctor of philosophy consisted of philosophy and everything else that the other three didn't. So the music, art, history, and what's called the natural sciences. Now, each of these four departments were very possessive and territorialistic. So if you were a philosopher, which also means the natural sciences, you were very protective of your subject matter as opposed to theology, and you didn't cross lines. So the natural scientists, as they do today, physical scientists, we might call them today, you know, demonstrate that everything happens under law. Even there are certain aberrations statistically, you statistically know how many times that aberration is going to happen. It occurs under law. Whereas the theology, completely different approach. Pretty much in that metaphysical realm, it was more important to get people believing dogmatic ideas rather than to investigate the truth of the matters. Well, really, theosophically speaking, and according to the ancient mystery schools, it's, you know, nature is nature, all departments, both physical, into the metaphysical, spiritual, whatever we call them. And the laws that operate in the physical operate in the metaphysical in their own different ways on those planes. So the question was, you know, we have these two opposing sets of, you know, areas of learning, science and the church. Well, when we get religions to bleach themselves of the false ideas, what's going to be left is the truth that really law reigns in the spiritual world. And when we get science to bleach itself of the fact that only the physical world is real, and that no laws operate in metaphysical ways as well, well, we're bringing science to become more of a religion, and religions to become more of a science, and that's what exactly theosophy is called. It's a religious science and a scientific religion, but for it to work, you have to dismiss false ideas.
And science is ever proving these metaphysical ideas. Karma, which we've been talking about, is cause and effect. And science showed that for every cause, there is an effect. The effect is in the cause, so it cannot be escaped. It must have its return. It proved to us the astral world. It took pictures that showed a starry sort of aura around what was being photographed. Well, they didn't know at the time, but that's a fantastic example of the astral world. And the we'll leave it there, but it's interesting because although science doesn't know it or perhaps doesn't admit it, it proves these ideas, and it's getting more and more of them and just putting them out as science. It's our job to look at them and say, wait a minute, that's also metaphysical. And I have to be the one to put them together and realize nature holds all of this, and I am nature in form. So we're all connected. There is no separation, although we don't recognize it or take responsibility for it sometimes. There really, truly is no separation. And when we act as if there were, we're acting out of harmony with nature, which is the opposite of our goal.
Yes.
And on a very primal level, we have created this anthropomorphic being. Instead of being us, it's a being. It's something outside of ourselves. And we're all, in a sense, vying for favors. Really, we want favors. That's miracles, we pray. And in the Catholic Church, for instance, if you can pray to a saint, someone who's been categorized as a saint, then they can intercede, because you're not even worthy enough to pray directly to God. So it's even one more level down. And so it's personality, which is what Theosophy stresses again and again and again, is to try to eradicate the personal and look at the universal, look at the individuality, not the personality. So we've created a monster, really. We call it God, but it's a monster. And it keeps one religion against another, because I have the true faith, we have the true beliefs. It's really the Tower of Babel is what it is. And most, unfortunately, if that stuff is Babel.
Very interesting point that we would that we would pray to that those, say, Catholics will pray to a saint in hopes of a miracle. And yet, in the language of the church, there's this subliminal and, we think, very deceptive idea. What does the church do when they make a person a saint? They canonize him. What's the canon? The canon law. So they make him one with the law. So there's this idea that when I pray to a saint, I'm louder, that behind it, there is the operation of law, which is why it's required before someone is labeled a saint that there be miracles, quote unquote, performed by them, which is validating from the church's perspective that things happen outside of the natural law. Unfortunately, it's limited just to the saints. And that's the catch. That's the keystone. If it's limited just to the saints, then you know it's a false idea. Because whatever the power is available to all self-conscious thinking human beings. How we use those powers is different among all of us. But as soon as a religion starts saying that this person has more power or is closer to God than another, and therefore you have to hold him out as an authority. That's the catch. That's the keystone. That's the catchword for it's a false idea. It's a false idea. Here in Theosophy, there is no authority except for the truth that's inherent in the ideas that are discussed and each person's insights and abilities to recognize that truth. There's no person who's an authority. Yes?
A number of times it's been said that the universal law is the law of cause and effect, which as we listen to it on the surface sounds very mechanical. But it is the way we observe it. Are we not taught in the philosophy that the universal law is that of harmony and balance, and that whenever there is a disturbance in that balance, the universe acts to restore that harmony and balance? So that's the universal law. Cause and effect is just the means by which it's brought about.
Absolutely. Cause and effect are the means by which the law of harmony is brought about. And that harmony exists and is for our use and is everywhere. It is in all kingdoms of nature, and we know when we're out of balance. We do something and we chose the little devil on the other shoulder instead of the angel, if you recall this old idea. Although we knew the right thing to do, we chose the easier thing or the more personal thing or the more selfish thing. Immediately we are out of balance and our responsibility is to begin to restore that. And that starts with what was said earlier, looking within and trying to find, what did I just do? Something doesn't feel right. Because if it's true and if it's right and if it's harmonious, you will feel it, and vice versa.
There was a hand here.
We're talking about the effect plane. We live in the effect plane. Everything is the effect of something. We think Theosophy is pointing to go to the causal plane. And that causal plane is our mind. How we think is what we become. And we were talking about metaphysics. Well, that thought plane is metaphysical. So we think in the Gita it says that we need to elevate that Arjuna, to that higher mind. We can't bring the higher mind down. We have to elevate it. So it's a matter of initiation, of purging oneself of these ideas that we are bombarded with all day long, all these images and this lower passional nature is being exploited in this world. So the mind is where we need to begin. You would think that all these things are a matter of what we think. The world we live in is an effect of those causes that we set up in a long time ago.
There are some wonderful pamphlets out there, and this one is simply called Karma. And it's all articles by Mr. Judge. We would highly recommend it because it looks at it from all angles, and it's $2. In one of the articles called Advantages and Disadvantages in Life, it talks about what was just said. Good karma is that kind which the ego desires and requires. Bad, that which the ego neither desires nor requires. And in this, the ego being guided and controlled by law, by justice, by the necessities of upward evolution and not by fancy or selfishness, revenge or ambition, is sure to choose the earthly habitation that is most likely out of all possible to give a karma for the real advantage in the end. So it's the desires, it's the, we forgot what you said, but we were connecting the two.
The plane of mind.
The plane of mind, right. If we look at our desires, we will certainly know what direction we are headed in, and that will affect what we do, these causes, these actions in nature, and know that those will have their return in a future life. So we are ever striving to elevate them, as was said.
Thank you. And what was mentioned here with respect to some of the teachings in the Gita, in this plane that we typically operate in, what we're saying is that this is not the plane of the plane of reality is the thought plane. The plane of true action is the thought plane. And we're mired, we typically mire ourselves through our lower mind and our passional nature into this world of what we call this world of opposites. All of this contrast. Now, yes, we're in a world of opposites, but we need those opposites to contrast so that we can learn when we compare, you know, high from low, good from bad, right from wrong, whatever you want to call it. But the idea is to not identify with all of these opposites, not associate and identify ourselves as that in this world, but rather than the observer of them, watching the interaction, observing it, and growing from it. So, you know, when we talk about law, to understand more about law, one, it is required to grow in wisdom. We all know you can be very knowledgeable about things, but that doesn't mean you're a wise person. What does it take to move from very knowledgeable to being wise? Yes?
Getting on the bicycle and putting that theory to use.
Turning off the TV and going outside and talking to people and getting involved? Okay.
Well, we also meant you can read about cycling, but until you actually get on a bicycle, you don't know anything about balancing and riding a bike.
Okay, so then similarly, by analogy, you can read all the theosophy, you can read every theosophy book ever written, but wouldn't we be learning a lot more if, while we're learning reading, we're actually practicing it? Would we not grow in wisdom? What else can be done? You know, what's the practical ways to pull yourself away from the average stuff of the daily day? What's good to do in the morning? Yes.
Well, the analogy of the gardener was set up so that the morning is the beginning of the day. It's the time for setting up the causes, getting a good start so we can plant the seeds or the causes of ideas that we want to be the principles by which we operate during the day. Just spend some time reflecting on that. So that's a good cause or a good way to start.
So then the contribution here is if we take the time, give ourselves 10 minutes in the morning to look at the day, kind of like we'll look at the table of contents of a book just to see where it's going, the effect of that is we'll be more conscious of what we're doing in the day, and rather than reacting to things, we're actually more proactive, setting up probably different kinds of causes, because we're thinking clearly about it and following our own plan rather than reacting to others. Yes, in the back. And then
another great method is to watch your attitude. Instead of saying, oh, I have to do the dishes, you say, I get to do the dishes. I am lucky. I have water. I have dishes. I have food. I get to do this.
Thank you. Yes?
As important as mind is. It's controlled by the heart. And that idea of compassion is deeply ingrained in every human being, in every human spirit. So we need to pay attention to our heart and listen to our mind and become more human. And I just looked at something yesterday, and it said, live simply so others can simply live.
Thank you. We have a question regarding that. That it's the heart that controls the mind. If we're talking about heart, man, it's the physical heart that sends more messages to the brain than we realize, and the idea is to have the mind operate through the heart along with the brain. Thank you. Yes.
I like your statement. A lot of times, me myself, a lot of situations that were stressful, when I started thinking differently about it, instead of thinking like it's being something that's bad, I thought about, oh, it's my turn today. So a lot of times, how you feel about a situation, like when I used to have to go to work, I used to work from 7 to 7, 12-hour shift, and I used to be like, oh, man, I got to work graveyard shift all the way to the next morning. And I used to say, you know what? I'm here to make me some good money. I'll meet some people. Me and Steve got a lot of time to get ourselves together. We don't get along, but I'm gonna work on getting along. So I thought about it being different, and time used to fly. I didn't used to go to sleep at the steering wheel no more. So I started feeling better about it.
Sure.
So everything worked out.
So what's being said here, and it depends on the attitude. It's almost like, you know, live your life as though everything is rigged in your favor.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And that'll change your attitude, you know? You know, it makes those 12-hour days go a little better, right?
The highest form of compassion is what the masters have said is the greatest law, the law of compassion. So as was said, I've decided to try and make my relationship better with this person today, not just do my work and make my money. So the compassion we seek is not only for ourselves, but much more for everyone else. And when we can't do anything about the Middle East right now. Well, yes, we can. We can anywhere in the world that needs help. We can send loving thoughts and compassionate desires for their benefit. So even far away, we can use compassion and be of service.
Well, I think to make it more poignant, well, everyone you meet today, either give them a smile or a hello. Just do it to anybody, everybody, and see how that changes your day.
Hello.
In the back.
We've heard in these rooms the term, resist not evil. Sufficient to the day is the evil thereof. And also, every failure is success. Well, that's the opposite of what most people think. When we are able to reach that state, can you say that we have risen above all karma?
Well, for an individual to recognize failure as success, you don't have to be a Mahatma. You know, if you look at success as, you know, a step forward, you know, as in the word, think of the word successive. If you, you know, if we come up against a brick wall and have to go around it rather than climbing over it, really, it's a matter of how you see. You know, life is not, or rather success is not measured, we have heard. Success is not measured by heights achieved, but by obstacles overcome. So the obstacles that come to us under law. dealing with those obstacles is the process of success. Living a successful life is not achieving a goal at a certain place at a certain time, but rather it's skill in the performance of action. Skill being on the plane of mind, skill being right thought, right discrimination and discernment, living a life of compassion, knowing along the path that we're walking, all of the dynamics that are going on as best we can between this and everybody else, acting, thinking, and behaving as though really we are the one who we are. That is the approach on the path. That's the approach to spiritual knowledge. The knowledge that everything we do along the path is part and parcel to everybody else. It's all one. So really, being on the path is the goal. As soon as we start focusing on something that I want to get by a certain time in a certain place, that has nothing to do with spiritual knowledge. That has to do with the desire nature, the lower nature, like we were talking about. And so that's one way to keep a check. So a lot of people think success is, I'm going to get this. And then I get it. And by the time they get it, aren't they ready? They're already focusing on something else to get, because they haven't satisfied that yearning toward the higher rather than toward the more.
The right living and right thinking, and there's a number of them, are the precepts of the Buddha. So take a look sometime. Look it up. It's simple yet complex. It's a way of living that overcomes the evil or the difficulty or whatever it is, because you are continuing along that path. And it is said the path varies with the pilgrim. So we can never know what another is going through, but we can be compassionate in looking through our eyes at theirs and trying to be of help and live the right life.
Yes, in the back.
We're told in the Voice of the Silence that if our goal for spiritual knowledge is that I should have spiritual knowledge, we're going to end up in a very different place. That we want to have the goal, I want this knowledge so I can give it to everybody else.
Thank you. Yes.
And there's always this one analogy that helps us become refocused in the moment, is that it's the analogy of a rider on a horse. If that rider lets the horse, well, just go, wherever you want to go, go, and I'm here and I'm going to enjoy the ride. And in fact, that's what many people do. And once you come to that place of responsibility, then you learn, well, maybe I can control this horse. Maybe I can make this horse go in a certain direction. Maybe I can make it walk fast or walk slow, but I'm in control. And when we use that analogy to look at ourselves, we realize who is in control, our lower nature or our higher nature. And that's the path we're all on.
And that's the sign that we're on the path, is just asking the question, who's in control right now, my higher nature or my lower nature? It's up to each individual under law to grow in certain ways, to understand how to maintain a more steady nature rather than to identify with the lower. It doesn't happen miraculously. We can, you know, an individual can pray to an outside God and say, make me more spiritual. If you want to develop patience within yourself, then develop patience within yourself. Now, with respect to, I plan to live my life in such a way so as others will grow in spiritual knowledge as well. That doesn't mean, even for a minute, that we can teach somebody else spiritual knowledge. It's not something that you read and learn and memorize. It's something that one grows into. So Mr. Crosby, who happened to be the founder of the United Lodge of Theosophists, so long ago, he wrote that, you know, really, you can't teach truth to another person, but the way that you live your life, you can help others see the truth in themselves if you live it and set the example. So if we want others to grow in those ways, we just need to do what we need to do for benefit of them rather than because that's what we want to have.
Absolutely. And we were thinking, we started way back talking about religion, and it's a fascinating exercise. If you go to a Catholic Mass, and whatever the prayers are, you substitute the word law for the word Lord, and it makes perfect sense. And it is very spiritual and very moving, and helps you understand that it really is universal. It's just been corrupted for the time being. So try that sometime. Take something, use it in a way in your mind and your heart that expands it and makes it universal. And you'll be very surprised at the results.
Actually, in a way, it's terrifying to take the Lord's Prayer and do that, because one of the statements slaps you in the face. Law, forgive my debts as I forgive my debtors. And I don't forgive my debtors very well, so it's a little terrifying. We have a lot of growing up to do.
It's a reminder.
We have a lot of growing up to do. Well, there's one statement Mr. Judge talks about in terms of growing in wisdom to understand the law better. And he says, in the end, wisdom and virtue go hand in hand. Virtue alone leads to heaven. Wisdom leads to union with the Supreme. In the end, they have to be together. But virtue practiced first will lead to wisdom. Wisdom pursued first, if we decide we need to grow in wisdom, that actually makes the cultivation of virtue all the faster. So make the effort. Live a good life, be a good person, do the right thing, but we have to back that up with knowledge of theosophical principles.
Absolutely. We want to finish with, again, a reading from an article from Mr. Judge in this pamphlet. The object that is indicated for life by all this is so to live and think during each life as to generate no new karma or cause for bondage while one is working off the stock in hand. In order that on closing each life account, one shall have wiped off so much as that permits. The old mental deposits will thus gradually move up into action and exhaustion from life to life, at last leaving the man in a condition where he can master all and step into true consciousness, prepared to renounce final reward in order that he may remain with humanity, making no new karma himself and helping others along the steep road to perfection. We think it's a perfect example of compassion. So our class is adjourned for the day. Thank you.
I really enjoyed it.
Do we do anything?